Hey guys, don't forget April 23rd through the 28th, 2023. We'll be in Nashville, Tennessee for the second Street Cop Training Conference. You do not want to miss out on that. So far, we have some real big headliners on there. It'll be 5 days of transforming training in Nashville, Tennessee.
111, 110, 25, 7, 3. You training to be a street cop?
Hey guys, welcome to this episode of the Street Cop Training Podcast. I'm your host, founder and CEO of Street Cop Training. My name is Dennis Bonino. Today I have a great guest. A lot of you probably haven't heard of him, but he wrote a book that's amazing, and I'll let him tell you all about that stuff. Without further ado, for candid purposes, I have with me T, and T will explain to you who he is and what he did. Thanks for being here.
Hi, thank you. Yes, Tamrael Nouri is the name I go by for this new line of work that I'm now in. And it's really a name from my past as well. I've been in law enforcement for 27 years. I started my career working undercover narcotics. And then sometime after 9/11, I was recruited and trained into the FBI's National Security Covert Operations Unit. And I have been working counterterrorism investigations for many, many years. And one of those cases got declassified for trial. And that led to, and it gave me the opportunity to write American Radical. And we were very proud of the book because it gave me that opportunity to send a message or give a message to the American people that's so near and dear to my heart.
The case that got declassified, tell us about that case a little bit.
I guess the best way to get into that one is there was a subject that there were some red flags regarding his communications overseas, his travel patterns and things of that nature. And the FBI wanted me to get in front of him in an undercover capacity to determine whether or not he was a threat. And we did determine that he was a threat, and that led to a full-on investigation.
So 27 years ago, you started in narcotics. What was it originally some of the things that you were doing then compared to what happened in 9/11, post-9/11? And we'll get to that because I think people are really going to be intrigued on what it was you were doing post-9/11.
That's a great question, Dennis, because the two worlds don't seem like they would merge, but there is one catalyst that translated from the narco world to the counterterrorism world. When I first started my career and working undercover narcotics, I was pretty awful. I mean, it's only by the grace of God and the amazing team I had behind me that I didn't die in those early years. When we're bad at something, it's easy to blame nerves or inexperience, but it was more than that. I quickly realized that I had a lot to learn after that first undercover buy because I did everything wrong. And I missed everything. I had tunnel vision. I was so preoccupied with simply getting the drugs in my hand and making sure he didn't think I was a cop. It wasn't until I flipped the script and started studying the drug world through the eyes of users and sellers that I realized the absolute foundation of undercover work was human connection. And in doing that, I was able to translate that to the world of counterterrorism because now we weren't fighting drug dealers who were motivated by greed, power, money, addiction. We were fighting an ideology. And the only way I could get close to some of these terrorists was to connect with them on a human level and not with what they were doing or trying to do.
How would you connect with them on a human level?
So it doesn't come down to what they were actually trying to do. Like I mentioned, they're trying to blow something up. They're trying to commit mass murder. It was about knowing them personally, their families, their motivations, everything that they stood for, I just connected with on a human level. What does that mean? So in this case, for example, the main target, Shaheb, he had a tremendous hatred for the West. And obviously 9/11 was personal to all of us, and he was trying to create all these mass murder plots in the US and Canada. So I needed to connect with him personally, understand why he had that hatred, where it came from, how he was radicalized. And I connected with the human part of him. And the human part of him, believe it or not, was pretty special. He was a world-renowned scientist that was on the precipice of curing some forms of cancer.
Wow.
His mind was truly a gift to humanity. That was the part I connected with and listened and watched his work. And when I was able to be a friend for him, he let me in and I was eventually indoctrinated into their cell.
So after 9/11, I'm going to go back a little bit here because I think people have probably lost a little insight in the timeline of the events that we've spoke about. You are placed into an undercover role with the intention of thwarting terrorist organizations.
Several years after the attack, after the Bureau wrapped their head around the new war we were in, I was recruited and trained by the FBI's National Security Covert Operations Unit, NCOS, as it's more affectionately known in my world. The National Security Covert Operations Unit is a very small, elite, covert counterterrorism task force dedicated to combating terrorism, domestically and abroad. All of the agents and operatives were plucked and pulled and recruited from law enforcement agencies across the country, each bringing with them a unique skill set to the team. And then, of course, we were trained by the entire alphabet of the U.S. government, and we essentially became these brand new hybrid agents. When we're tasked with working stateside, we put our law enforcement hats on, and we do what police officers do. We collect evidence, and we build a prosecutable case for the U.S. attorney. When we're tasked with working overseas or abroad, we put our spy hats on and simply gather intelligence to further the mission. It was a brand new way to fight the war on terror.
Why do you think you were chosen?
Well, I speak Arabic like I speak English, without the Jersey accent, of course. I know the true meaning of the religion. I know the culture. I was born in Egypt and came to the States when I was a young boy, so I could flip the script pretty good. And I had several years of undercover experience in the narcotics world. So it was just a matter of transitioning and understanding that. But make no mistake about it, Dennis, the worlds were very different. I had to relearn my upbringing and understand the major differences and the nuances between mainstream Islam and the radical mindset. I knew my religion growing up, but I was far from an expert. I had to know it better so I could understand how these people twisted a religion of peace for their own agendas. And then I had to learn what those agendas were. It was a tremendously long process of getting into this role. But when I got there, I was thankfully able to be successful.
How deep undercover did you go?
I guess the answer there is pretty much as deep as you get. For the better part of the last two decades, I had been a royal pain in the ass to Al-Qaeda and ISIS because my job, simply put, was to put my arm around some of the worst people on the planet, convince them that I was their best friend, no matter what it took, and then ruin all their plans of death and destruction.
So I'm guessing that means that you traveled abroad, were in some ways playing a role. And when I think about this, I'm thinking about Joe Pistone, which I think if you're friends with Donnie Brasco, right?
Yes, I am.
If you haven't seen the movie Donnie Brasco, it's worth a watch. It's actually a real story. Joe Pistone was an undercover FBI agent who infiltrated the mob. It's kind of a similar story here, but except you were infiltrating Al-Qaeda and ISIS abroad.
That's correct.
Were you think you were ever suspected of being a spy or an outsider or an American?
I'm sure on several occasions, especially when you work abroad, you're pretty much on your own. There's no backup like here in narcotics. There's no team, you know, an extraction team around a corner. You're on your own. So you had to figure out what it meant, how to operate on foreign soil without being detected and without any backup. So it was a completely different world. Did my rooms get tossed? Did things happen? Absolutely. By good guys and bad guys, because that's the nature of the covert world.
If you were being looked at by an organization, and I don't mean the bad guys, I mean the good guys, was there intelligence back here known that you were involved? And if at some point you had to make a call to get yourself out of it, you could do that?
Yeah, there's stopgaps in place, of course, for the work that we do, because it's imperative, obviously. The U.S. government doesn't leave us out to dry like you see in the movies and things like that. We have rules of engagement, and we know what we can and can't do. And we're, as long as you operate within those boundaries, you're protected and you're safe.
Were there moments in your undercover work that you were scared at all?
Yeah, I would say so. There's a handful of times when you know that things could go bad really quick. And, you know, the older you get, the more experience you get, the more mistakes you make, you realize the bullets that you've dodged. And you also realize what you can and can't do in certain situations so as to never put yourself in those positions.
Do you think that these organizations were running counter surveillance on you, watching what you're doing?
Absolutely. I mean, they're a lot more sophisticated than people think, but they're not as technologically savvy, I think, as we give them credit for sometimes. So there's a happy middle in there, but yes, the short answer is anyone new is being inspected very thoroughly.
When do you think it came to a point where you weren't considered new anymore and they felt like they could trust you? How long did that take?
All of my work in infiltrating, whether it was a lone wolf or a terrorist organization, most of it came before I even got on target. I did my homework, and that is the beauty of what we get to do. We get to insert ourselves in people's lives at the right time, so it appeared serendipitous for them. Mm-hmm. When that happens, it puts you in a position to be successful. And then it's just the human connection part that I mentioned earlier. It's imperative that you form that bond. And then you let nature take its course. So sometimes you have to take your time. And other times, if the threat level is immediate, you have to push fast forward on that whole situation.
When you started infiltrating some of these organizations or these people, I think a lot of us have and I'm not trying to downplay the seriousness of these sociopathic, whatever you want to consider them, because I think that there's got to be something loose in your head to want to kill people. Let's say facts. But I'm curious about a few things. I think in our minds, we constantly imagine, maybe painted by Hollywood, this vision of this person who's constantly mad, constantly screaming. They're just wild, nonstop lunatic people. Were they constantly mad?
You know, it's funny. I never thought of it that way. No one's ever asked me that question. But yes, no. Constantly mad is a great way to put it. But can they have normal conversations within that anger? Here's the thing. The best way to answer that question, Dennis, is to tell you that the jihadi mindset or the mujahideen mindset is all about staying on the path of Allah. What that means to mainstream Muslims or the Jewish or Christian or any God-fearing person is you simply stay on the path of God, avoid temptation, avoid committing sins, and do good by others, and eventually you'll go to heaven. But to a radical, it means something totally different. It means that while you are embedded in the Western world, your enemy's land, everything you do serves a purpose. And that purpose is your mission of jihad. If you get a job in the Western world, it becomes your cover so you can live amongst them as them to defeat them. So their day in and day out, everything they do is to serve that mission. When something takes you over and it becomes all you do, there's a level of anger that is there and isn't going away.
What did you find out about these people that surprised you, that you didn't know of prior to going into this function, this capacity?
Believe it or not, for the vast majority of them, is the smarter they were, the easier it became for them to get brainwashed. Take Shaheb, for example, one of the bad guys in my book, the main bad guy. He was a lost soul, but he was a brilliant scientist. And Al-Qaeda preyed on that. They took him in and they showed him videos of drones killing children and things of that nature. And they just, over an extended period of time, created a monster. And like I mentioned, because he had that need to connect, he was very vulnerable. Intellectually, brilliant. Emotionally, a child. And that's what I found that all of them had in common.
Drones killing children, where is that at?
Meaning footage that you see,
okay,
of the war that took place in Afghanistan, Iraq. They're showing them the atrocities that the West is doing onto their women and children. So they brainwash him as saying that America is the big bad wolf and that you need to go get your revenge.
The other side isn't shown that, right?
Correct.
We had Lieutenant Colonel Scott Mann on. And his job as a Green Beret and Lieutenant Special Forces was to go in and win the hearts and minds of the tribes of Afghanistan. And he said one thing he would do to start is to show them why they were there and show them video footage of 9/11 and real, real raw stuff. to let them understand why they were motivated to be there. And that's when people understood in these villages who were being attacked by the Taliban, why the Green Berets were there and asking them to fight with them.
Brilliant.
And he said that he often is able to create these bonds with these people who don't know him or trust him by telling a story. And the thing's called rooftop leadership. And why he talks about rooftop leadership is because when he was defending these villages with these elders and these people in Afghanistan, they would be on the rooftops fighting the Taliban, who knew that they were there and coming to attack them. So that's where they found this leadership, and that's where he named the program. Let me ask you this. These people, do they have families? What are they like as fathers and husbands and friends? Did you ever see them in a different light at all?
Absolutely. They all do. And they put a wall up between their jihadi views and whatever it was they were doing in their family life. Shaheb, for example, he wasn't married, but his mother, his brothers, his father were all mainstream Muslims in Tunisia. And they begged and pleaded with him not to go down to the dark side, but he was too far gone by the time he got to Canada.
What happened to Shaheb, and who is he? What did he do?
Shaheb was trained by Al-Qaeda and sent here to conduct terrorist attacks in North America. He had several different plots that came about throughout his training, but his initial target and goal was to derail and blow up a train from New York City to Toronto. He and his co-conspirator, Ra'ed Jasser, were both tried and convicted and sentenced to life in prison in Toronto. And another co-conspirator, Ahmed Abbasi, took a plea in New York City shortly thereafter.
What was he sentenced to in New York?
He only got about 2 years and then was deported.
Earlier, you said that these people come here to infiltrate the West, get jobs, blend in while they plot their attacks. Do you have any idea how many people may actually be here, sitting here trying to build these cells? And is it still a real thing?
I think the important thing, and one of the reasons why I wrote American Radical, is we want to take that away from them. The ability to live amongst them as them, to defeat them, we want to take that away from them. We know Al-Qaeda's playbook after we got punched in the mouth in 9/11. So the way to do that is to understand the fundamental differences between the radical mindset and the true tenets of the religion. And that's what American Radical did. It gave you their playbook. This is the difference between an individual, a Muslim American who is just devout, and here's the difference between a terrorist who is actually trying to hide his true intentions.
How motivated is Al-Qaeda and ISIS today?
I don't think that motivation ever goes away, Dennis. I think a lot of it is media driven here today as to whether or not it's the flavor of the month, you know, based on, you know, what's happening in the world. But their world, their day to day, is that anger that they have towards us.
What's a great story that you wouldn't mind sharing that maybe not be as sensitive, that maybe you tell comfortably in a setting where you have some?
Yeah, no. Well, I'll tell you, you had said some really nice things to me before we got off air because you know about the book and you know about my career. But I'll tell you, there was one time during this particular investigation when I wasn't very much a professional. And it was with Shaheb in New York City. After we had seen Times Square, a couple of nights later, we were walking and I had just about had my fill of all his anger and hatred towards the West. And he stopped downtown in front of the Freedom Tower as it was being built and looked it up and down. He put his arm around me and while rubbing his beard, he said, "Tamer, this town needs another 9/11 and we're going to give it to them." At that moment, I could feel my carotid artery bulging through my neck. It was 20 degrees outside, but I started to sweat. I knew I was losing my shit, but I couldn't stop it. That never happened to me before while on target. I realized quickly, after all this time, how close this case was to home. I shoved him off of me before he even finished his sentence, and I jumped in my car. And I pretended that something I ate earlier didn't agree with me, and I screeched out onto the West Side Highway and drove directly to the safe house. I spooked him that night. And we were in the process of trying to identify the American sleeper when this happened. Everyone that was listening to everything that was happening at the JOC, the Joint Operations Command Center, was losing their mind. Like, what's he doing? It wasn't until the next morning when I didn't sleep. I got my shit together, refocused. Shaheb died to me that night. I spent a year connecting with him. And something broke in me that night. I was able to salvage the situation. But even as undercovers, no matter how professional we are, when we're somewhere like that, that's so personal to all of us, anything can go awry.
Human being, dude.
We're human beings.
Yeah, exactly. What are you going to do? I mean, there are moments that as this company continues to grow, and I probably talk about this a lot, that I remind people that, look, I'm going to make mistakes. I'm just a human like everybody else. I've done it. And sometimes I balance between, should I apologize for what I said or did? Do I apologize? How do people know, you know, what I'm going through mentally? I just did my fourth quarter schedule and I'm going on the road more than I thought I wanted to for purposes that this company, I have to do it. I don't have a choice. It's part of the deal. But people don't know what I'm going through or what I'm dealing with personally when I'm on the road away from my family. You know, so there are moments where, especially I'm talking 10 hours a day, where I, and I don't mean to make this about me, I'm just trying to relate as a human of mistakes, where I might say or do something where somebody actually is like, I didn't agree with that. And I'm like, you know what? I didn't either. I don't know why the fuck I said that. And I don't know why my mind went there. When you're talking for 10 hours and it's a lot of it is really just freelance talking. I'm just on the spot, improv. That's why people come to classes. They're like, wow, I took a class, this class 18, 25 months ago. And it's different again. And I'm like, yeah, because I'm not the same. It's not one trick. I show up with a new, fresh set of thoughts every single time I show up. Sometimes those old thoughts I wish I remembered, but so yeah, it happens. Let me ask you this. What was his reaction when he found out you were an undercover?
So on April 22nd, 2013, arrests were made and search warrants were executed simultaneously in New York, Toronto, and Montreal. Shaheb was arrested in Montreal and immediately transferred to Toronto. He was waiting for me. He was interrogated for weeks and he never once gave me up. He protected me at every turn. Even though they played recordings for him of our most private conversations, he just assumed the government found a way to record us and they were trying to trick him. About a month later, after he got enough discovery, after he finally sank in that I was FBI, he broke his silence, but not to investigators, to the media. We had a special goodbye that we used to say to each other. It was a constant reminder that we were two Mujahideen brothers on the path together. It was very unique, and we'd say it every time we'd say goodbye. So when he broke his silence to the media, he called in some reporter from Toronto for a jailhouse interview. And he kept the conversation very general and smart. He didn't talk about the case, but he asked the reporter to print something for him at the very end of his article, which he did. And it was that special goodbye. When I first read that, Dennis, I thought that was his way of saying goodbye to me one more time, that he understood. It wasn't until about a year and a half later when I saw him again for the first time in the courtroom of his trial that I realized what he was actually saying to me. That look of hatred and evil that he had in his eyes towards the West was now directed right at me the entire time I was on the witness stand, 3.5 weeks. What he was using that reporter to say to me was, fuck you, Tamer. You didn't win. You can't win this war.
So were there any other interactions with him? Did he say anything to you directly?
One time during my testimony, he lost his shit. I made a mention of how this wasn't true Islam, that the true Islam is such and such. And he had a warped vision. He was quiet throughout the entire testimony till I said that, because he was so brainwashed as to what quote unquote true Islam was, that he felt the need to stand up and shout. He was in this fish bubble in the courtroom in Toronto. And while he was losing his mind, throwing stuff and screaming,
wow,
the judge cleared the courtroom. Now, mind you, it was only a jury and my security detail because the media wasn't allowed to see me. They had to get shifted to a different courtroom. They weren't allowed to record me in any way, but they could hear me and hear my testimony. So he cleared the jury and he let him vent towards me and kept it moving.
Are you still a practicing Muslim?
Yes, absolutely. Am I as religious as I want to be? No. But yes, I am a Muslim American and I'm proud of it.
How about your parents?
Yes.
They're still around.
My father, yes.
How did 9/11 affect them?
You know, it's funny because my father prays for the death of Al-Qaeda and ISIS every day. My sister won't even say their name because it's associated with our religion. But they don't have a voice. They don't have a voice of the millions of Muslim Americans that are here. Law enforcement, non-law enforcement. Right. I did. This was a perfect storm for me. I am a Muslim American and I was in a position with the highest security clearances to be in possession of a case that got declassified because the bad guys decided to take me to trial. Everything I've ever done in the world of counterterrorism for our government, no one's ever going to hear about. And that's a good thing. I'm okay with that. This particular case, these bad guys decided to take me to the hoop and the Department of Justice had no choice but to declassify it for trial. And that's why I was able to tell my story and that's why I was able to have a voice for those that don't have one.
Does Al-Qaeda and ISIS now know through this declassification who you were? And
they don't know my true identity.
Okay.
But yes, they obviously now that it was a book and there was 60 Minutes, there was all kinds of stuff. So yes.
You still live, and I'm guessing for the remainder of your life, in a very undercover capacity.
Yes.
I know you traveled very, very far to be here today. And I appreciate that. I know it's not easy to take this kind of trip out here to do this kind of program. It's really cool to meet you today as well. What's that like living, maybe looking over your shoulder constantly?
I would say it was a lot easier about 10 years ago, but now with cameras everywhere you go and everyone's got a camera on their phone, it's a little bit harder to stay off the grid, so to speak. It's just my biggest concern isn't for me, it's the people that are close to me. Mm-hmm. I raised my hand, I volunteered to do this work, and I'm proud of the work that I've done. And most of the cases that I've worked that no one will ever hear about are what I'm most proud of. But obviously for friends and family, that's where my concern lies. But it becomes second nature to live this way.
Do your parents know what you did?
My father has yet to read the book. He has it on his nightstand, and I believe he will read it when I eventually retire.
When 9/11 occurred, there are not many people who even listen to this that may have been alive or remember it. I remember it very well. I don't think you're too far off in age. I don't think it's something that I'll ever forget. And I was unhappy, and I don't know how often it happened, but I remember there being a sense of anti-Muslimism in the United States. I don't know how deep that ran. I don't have enough context to comment on it, but I'm relieved to hear, and I'm proud that you said it on this program to remind people that there are millions of Muslims who are being ill represented by the media and comparing them to organizations that they are completely disgusted by, like Al-Qaeda and ISIS. So does the Muslim community try to help law enforcement identify anybody that they may be suspicious of?
Absolutely. And it's funny because in this book, I highlight a situation where we watched how Shahab used to go to the mosque in Montreal, and then he was disgusted by their views. And he said, they're worse than the enemy because they're supposed to be Muslims. They don't understand, quote unquote, true Islam. So these radicals, they view true Muslims as an affront to their agendas. So they actually go the other way because they view them as enemies.
Wow, it's interesting. Obviously, I mean, if you look into world events and world issues, Muslim on Muslim is a common thing in other countries outside of here. You do some speaking engagements. When you do those speaking engagements, what are some of the things that you like to talk about to a crowd of people that maybe you could share with us here?
Sure. Yes. As a matter of fact, as I enter the winter of my career, Dennis, that's the new business I've launched. My website will be live in about a week. which we're very excited about. It's AmericanRadical.com. I will be giving keynote speeches in the corporate and civilian world, and the name of the speech is called Making Radical Connections. It's the importance in today's day and age, with everything that's been happening, of connecting with one another, making human connections as told through the eyes of a covert operative. I will essentially give the civilian world my playbook for connecting with a human being and the importance of doing it. So if I can connect with drug dealers and terrorists, then we all can connect with each other to make this world, to make our country a better place. It's going to be very selective, these speaking engagements, for the obvious security concerns that we just discussed. If corporations and entities can adhere to the very normal, nothing big security protocols, I'll be able to tell my story live and in person, which I'm very much looking forward to.
That's awesome. You ever read the book called Never Split the Difference by Chris Voss?
Yes, I'm a big fan of his.
Have you ever met him?
No, I never met him. I think he was before my time.
Yeah, he was a top FBI negotiator. His company's called the Black Swan Group. This guy better give me a free spot in his class for how many times I fucking promoted on this podcast. When we say making radical connections, what do you think the most, you talked about earlier there being a vulnerability, and then it's so interesting. I literally watched a TED Talk. This is a new thing I'm on every morning, right? I'm watching TED Talks with my coffee. Actually, my son today said, Why do you watch this every morning? It's like 7 o'clock in the morning. I'm drinking coffee. And I said, well, he goes, are you trying to get smarter? And I went, yeah, I'm trying to get smarter. I go, what did you want to watch? I go, you want to watch Nick? He goes, what's Nick? I go, Nickelodeon. He goes, yeah, I want to watch Nickelodeon. I go, well, in like 15 minutes, it's almost done. But the one I watch is How to Spot a Liar. And it was interesting that we're having this conversation now and the serendipity of it. They found that real profound liars target the vulnerability of people. And I forgot what she said in the presentation, but there was this historic liar. This guy was like one of the best of all time. And he said, everybody's got a vulnerability. You just got to figure out which one it is.
That was one of my favorite TED Talks. I watched well. And when she used the Clinton reference and she put the videos up, it was brilliantly done. She and her demeanor was amazing.
Yeah, it's excellent. Yeah. You know, it's interesting. We have a guy here who does, actually my old partner, does body language, behavioral analysis. He came into the office last week and I'm like, hey, he's my old partner with my old police department. And, you know, I'm like, he's like, look at you with the fucking confident layback. I'm like, dude, can you stop fucking analyzing me here? You just start digging into my vulnerabilities. You're my friend, you motherfucker. Like, don't do this to me. I do it to people too. You know, a lot of times people, I don't even want to do in podcasts. I can speed read people pretty quickly. I can tell when somebody likes something I says or dislikes something I says. And I've had this gift for a while. And I don't want to say gift. I learned it. I went to a course years and years ago given out by Haida. I'm talking like 15 years ago. It was free. It was in New York City. And it's interesting how important it is to understand human behavior and vulnerabilities. But that's important stuff. Here, you know, as the leader of an organization, I'm constantly trying to ensure that everybody's happy. That's my number one priority here. A lot of soul searching going on constantly, making sure that I'm showing up and delivering to everybody. But Frank, you haven't been here that long, but you could walk around this office. People have been here a while. And I'm like, come on, let's go to my office. They're like, why? I'm like, because I know something's bothering you. No, I'm fine. No, I can't. I don't like a guy, like you text me and say, hey man, we got to talk. Like that shit better be right now. Because I can't live with the anxiety of what's wrong. It drives me fucking nuts. So in say vulnerabilities, how is this translated to these organizations? And I don't mean criminal organizations. I mean, what's the objective of somebody taking a course? What can they learn? You're saying identifying the vulnerabilities, finding that human connection. Can you elaborate about that a little bit more?
Of course. And the keynote speech that I give, it's important for me to break down for people the terrorist mindset. And you can't just generalize. No one learns being generalized. No one understands any points that you're trying to get until you tell them a story. We all like to be entertained. I have a powerful story with twists and turns and three bad guys and their mindsets where I can break them down and I can explain to you individually and personally for each one of them, the terrorist indicators that you can see and the difference between what they're doing and what a true Muslim would do. Then I tell you the story and I give you the playbook as to how I connected with them. This is how I connected with him. And this is the decisions we made. And this is what happened when we found out about the American sleeper cell. And this is what happened when we realized that he was trying to blow up a train when we thought we only had a week and a half to stop it, et cetera, et cetera. And I think at the end of it all, no matter what you do for a living, whether you're law enforcement, intelligence, corporate, sales, that lesson that I give you, and I hope that you're able to take whatever I say and incorporate that in your world and realize the next time you're sitting in front of someone that you may not see eye to eye with, or you see the world completely differently than they do, you'll have a decision to make and you'll think, you know what? It might be better for both of us to find a common ground and move forward. Because after 9/11, if you recall, there was a revived sense of patriotism hope in this country that we as a nation would prevail. Now, on the heels of this never-ending pandemic and all the civil unrest, our world is upside down right now. Mm-hmm.
I often say to people, as sad as it's, because people say to me, obviously as a thought leader in law enforcement, when do you think it'll shift back? And my response is, the sad news is, the only time I've actually seen the cops being held on shoulders and carried through the streets was post 9/11. People could not do enough for the police. I think everybody was inspired to be a cop, wanted to help the fight. And you know what that means. It means it will take another catastrophic event before people realize that the police are your protectors, are your heroes. And although the job may not seem pretty at times, it's an important job that needs to get done. You know, it's interesting where we're in a place now. If you look at some of the TikTok comments, and I don't think it's a far majority, but the idealism of these up and coming generations that the police should do nothing and just leave everybody alone. What good are laws if you don't enforce them? What do we have laws for? I was watching a Yankees game last night. I went to the stadium, and New York is interesting because I remember it as a kid and I watched it change for the better and now watching it change back. Even though it is not completely chaotic in some sense, where the media may paint it as that, and I may be even guilty of that, to push my agenda to promote the support of law enforcement, especially the men and women of the NYPD who are, I don't know how you show up to work every day with that mindset to do this job under that administration or the people. But you start to see the beginning of it. And the beginning of it for me is like, here are the dirt bikes coming down the fucking street. You know, here are people on scooters, they're going down closed roads, weaving in out of police cars, and the cops just not doing anything. That's the beginning of it. That's not the significant problem. That's just the early signs of how much more chaos are we going to permit? There are laws for a reason. Do I think it's the biggest crime in the world for a guy to ride a scooter with no helmet? No, but that's the beginning of it. They start not fearing the police anymore. It is no longer a fear, and you should have a fear and a trust and the fear of, if I break the law, there's going to be consequences. I don't think you should fear cops as human beings. I think you should fear the consequences of law enforcement. But the things that you talk about, there's some real power in that.
Thank you.
How does the power of connecting and human connection work for everybody, even down to the lowest patrolman? Does it help them as well?
Absolutely. Think of it this way. The biggest problem and disconnect that law enforcement is having with communities right now, even if you were to have, let's say you're a supervisor, a chief of police, and you're having these community events to generate a connectivity of some sort with your police officers. As that chief, what if one for the next event, you were to challenge each and every one of your officers to make a human connection with just two people? That's it. Your sole purpose over the next 4 or 5 hours is to connect with someone in your community, two people, where they work, where they're from, their background, their family, where they live, what their aspirations are. Every member of that community goes home that day with a new friend in the police department. That's the power of human connection, because now you know names and faces and things become more personal. And that's just the tip of it for police officers. And law enforcement is the beauty of being able to connect and shed the persona that a police officer can't serve and be connected to their community. And that goes even more so in the corporate world. When you don't know someone and you're trying to, I'm not going to pretend to know that world, because for 27 years, I was in law enforcement and intelligence, and I still am. And that's obviously my wheelhouse. But I'll make the argument that every successful endeavor that we undertake, the foundation to that is human connection.
When we talk about your ability to have human connection and how long it took you to figure that out, I'm assuming you had training on the subject and the matter. Knowing that training is really something that helps resolve a lot of issues, especially in a professional environment, what's your thoughts on the current state of police training as somebody who's been in law enforcement for 27 years? And I want you to go back to the beginning of when you went to your first basic training course, what you took out of that, what it is now, has it really changed that much? And where are we failing?
I think there's some legislators that are having knee-jerk reactions to the political climate that are installing training that they believe, through some measure, which I don't know and I can't speak of, is the proper training. The truth is, every single training we do should include some version of tactics, laws, and responsibility to the community. If you don't incorporate those three things to every training, whether it's just learning a new law or a new skill set within law enforcement, if you don't incorporate all of them, then you are lacking in training. I'm not saying that that's not what's happened. I can't really speak because I'm a dinosaur, and I don't think it's been several years since I've been to any training, being a executive management in law enforcement right now. But I will say that those are the three things that you need for training in order to, for training to be successful, especially for these young men and women coming up today.
One thing that I think will help tremendously and to build the support of law enforcement in our communities is training on humanity and compassion, but properly training on humanity and compassion. When I think about how many cops need to get trained annually, there's only one way to do it appropriately, because we have very limited resources that are that valuable, that have the actual training ability to come in and make a difference. And I think at first, the idea of a lot of stuff going digital will seem very unorthodox, but I would actually argue that if you actually had digital training that was significantly better, significantly, I mean, eons beyond something that maybe in person, especially like these train the trainer courses. You ever see this shit?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, we're going to send three guys to this thing. They'll come back. They'll train 200 of us. Mm-hmm. You send them for a 6-hour course to be taught by the expert, the guy who invented this maybe theory, process, item. And you're going to have your guys come back in 6 hours and know it so well that they're ready to train people. And it's this thought process of, well, we don't have the money. I constantly think, you don't have the money, but you could find the money, right? You could fundraise the money. There could be a better way of doing it. And I have a real passion for identifying the people in this profession who actually have some real answers and not just have to come up with answers because that's their job title. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that we are doing a continued disservice to the world by staying the same and doing things the way we've always done them. I find it very interesting that law enforcement is one of the very few professions where people are so goddamn romantic with the past of how it was that they just won't release their romance with how it was when they were there to make things better. And as I say that, I think about the drill instruction in police academies. We're screaming at recruits for 6 months to put them on the street to try to be compassionate. You know what I mean? And I get it. I think there should be some trial of difficulty, because law enforcement, it is difficult at times. And you've got to know where your limits are and understand that you can push past those. I went to my third academy, literally they didn't stop till the end. We were doing push-ups on graduation day, getting ready to go into the world. And then we show up and we're charged up, man. We're ready to rock and roll. We've been practicing how to chase people down and all this stuff. And then, you know, that's not the game. You know, what's your thoughts on what we're doing now? I mean, I know this is kind of the same thing as the past, but somebody who is executive management, Where do you see the future of law enforcement training going for it to be, actually be effective?
I think you nailed it when you said we need to train our young officers today with compassion. Compassion and humanity. And legislators actually have incorporated some of those things that are required training that is helping. But you're right. When you go to a police academy and the way the media puts police officers out there in movies and things of that nature, they're always the badasses that are foot chases, all the shows that you grew up with. That's the subliminal mentality when you graduate a police academy. But if you incorporate, like you said, Dennis, enough compassion and humanity and human connection, regardless, and you view the civilian community as a friend and not your enemy or a target, it's a game changer for these young kids growing up.
I don't think there can be any other way to do it. And sometimes people have a hard time understanding what my objective here is at Street Cop Training of what I'm trying to do. I think I've just been accustomed to dealing with these people of like, why are you trying to make it worse when we're trying to make it better? And that ruffles feathers, T, when I say things like that. Mm-hmm. If you have administrations who are ticket-centric, who say, fuck that guy, right? But I'll argue all day that I think you should be looking for the guys wanted for raping three kids. And they're here. They're in the back seats of cars not wearing seatbelts. They're on bikes, not violating bicycle law. It doesn't take much to get to them and then take them off the street. Because if you do that for me and my kids don't get affected or subjected to being a victim of this animal, it's way better than writing a ticket in my book. That's just me. And when somebody has built a career around a book a day is a great productive day at work of tickets, and I show up and say this, and it's true, well, it hurts feelings. And I'm the Antichrist. But what else can you do to try to promote the progression? You want people on our side? Are you helping or hurting? And there's nothing I can do. That's what I believe in. But anyway, what last thoughts of this program? What do you want to get out? What do you want to promote again? And any final things that you want to give to the community?
No, that's just that I hope that people who read my book realize that Americans come in all shapes, sizes, colors, religions, creeds, and that everyone in this country is America. And what makes us the greatest nation in the world is that is our diversity. Mm-hmm. And when we embrace that, we will get back to who we are.
Yeah. Last night, I keep bringing up Yankee Stadium, the correlation to it. When I walked through the gate, and these guys are never going to hear it, but I saw a black female, Hispanic sergeant, and then a Jewish patrol officer with a yarmulke on. And I went, that just goes to show you that the humanity of these people, regardless of where they came from, showing up to do a job in a time where it could be the toughest to ever do this job. And in my mind as an off-duty police officer, I'm saying to myself, anybody fucks with these motherfuckers, I'm in, right? Like, I'm in. Like, you have no idea how fast I'm going to have your back. It's going to be quick, boys and girls. I mean, I'm constantly slowing down, making sure the troopers are safe. My kid on the way home last night goes, are you checking on your friends again? Those your police friends? I go, every single time, pal. You always slow down and make sure these guys are all right. And T, I'm just waiting for that time that I see them in a struggle on the side of the road. Your boy's coming. And he's coming and he's going to fucking be swinging. You know, I mean, I'm coming. I mean, I'll use my truck, whatever I got to do, but I'm coming out to help you. And I want to implore everybody to take a moment. Dude, sometimes I see a cop, maybe it's three streets down from where I'm going to turn. I just take the long way. That's it. I go three streets up. Just make sure the guy's okay. I don't get involved. I'm not pulling up like, hey, you need a nine, bro? You need backup? You need help? You got a 13 situation? No, I just drive by and make sure they're not fighting. That's it. Mm-hmm. And I've probably done that a couple hundred times in my life. Went out of my way to ensure the cop was okay. And last night I always tell my kids, tell the police officers you said thank you. Like, I know it's not easy, guys. I wish I could do everything for you. The only thing I could do is just continue to give support, express it as a retired police officer, and have my eye out for you to make sure that you're okay. And I'm really proud of all of them to show up and do that job. It's a tough time. And I know that I say things about the NYPD, but in the sense of defending the men and women who are in the ranks, because I don't think any humans, especially people who are giving so much for so little, deserve to be treated like they're shit. I'll never understand that. Well, it was a pleasure having you here, my friend.
It was my pleasure. Thanks so much for having me, Dennis. Yeah.